I just want to introduce you to three people before we start. The first one was a secretary, and she became a disciple maker. The second one was a Queen's Counsel, a high-ranking legal, solicitor, you'd say, but way beyond that. And he became a preacher. The third one was a farm laborer, and he became a mission pioneer. Now, who were all these people? Well, you don't know them. You've never met them. But they were all people who I met as a teenager and growing up, and I grew up with, and I can think of many more like them. And the thing about them is they were all ordinary people who did extraordinary things for the Lord. But there was something which is particularly common with them. I'll just take you through some of the pictures if I can. This she wouldn't appreciate it if I told you her name, but she's a missionary in Japan now anyway, so she wouldn't know. She was an amazing person. I used to go on beach missions with her. As we went on beach missions, there were a number of folk came to know the Lord. It's a Catholic country, the Southern Ireland, so it was a Catholic country. There was no churches for them to go to. Some of them were responded to in a very hostile way. She saw it. God put these young children upon her heart, and she started corresponding with them, and she did Bible studies by correspondence as she discipled these young people, and there were many hundreds of people. She spent hours a week writing to them beyond her normal job. She was a secretary. You think you'd write enough, don't you, as a secretary? And she spent hours a week corresponding with them, and there are many who are going on with the Lord because of her. The Queen's Counsel I talked about, and I definitely can't use his name because he was involved in terrorist prosecutions in Northern Ireland, but he was a very busy man. He was the chief public prosecutor in Northern Ireland. But he was wandering through the streets of Belfast, and in the streets of Belfast, he realized there were people passing by who would never hear the gospel, and he decided to do something about it. God touched his heart, and so he gathered a team of people around him and started an open air. Now, it's not the kind of open air you might see here where you've got one person standing isolated on a box in the middle. He gathered a team with him, so the whole team would be there listening with him. And so other people would think, there are people listening to this guy, we'll join them. And so you gradually had more and more people listening in the crowd, and the team were all trained up to contact those who were around them, and he got folk up doing testimonies. That he started, I guess, 40 years ago, and there's been an ongoing witness once a week, every week since then. Many, many thousands of people who have been influenced in the gospel. And that was the first place. He did exactly what I did to others tonight. He invited me to come up and told him, you've got 5 minutes to tell them the gospel. And there I was, having to think what to do. And so he was involved in training me. Now, you won't see a lot of what's on here, but there are lots of different pictures. But that farm laborer I want to talk about, he was an old man when I knew him. He's now been with the Lord for many years. He was a Brussels sprout picker. That was his job, and he was just a farm laborer, but him and a friend were on holiday. They saw the people on the beaches around the UK and realized there's a huge gospel opportunity, and they founded United Beach Missions. There's now 1,500 people each year go across many, many centers to communicate the gospel. They're working in Spain, France, Belgium, Netherlands, as well as England, Scotland, Wales, and Southern Ireland. And there are many, many thousands of people who've come to know the Lord because of that one person. What do they all have in common? What they all have in common is that they saw a need. God impacted that need upon their hearts. And although they were ordinary people, they decided to do extraordinary things for God. In a real sense, they were kingdom builders. They are kingdom builders. Well, God did. Now, what we're coming to is we're coming to a possibly extraordinary man. And we can look at Nehemiah and think, this man is somewhat different from us. He was cupbearer to the king, an extraordinary position of power and influence. But in reality, Nehemiah was a man just like us. I love it when we look at Elijah, and we get to the book of James in chapter 5, and it says Elijah was just a man like us. He prayed three times and it didn't rain. He prayed three times again and it rained. And you're thinking, no, he's not a man like us. But God says he is. And these people, they're people who are just like us. And Nehemiah was a person just like us. And yet God was at work in his heart, and God did extraordinary things through him. Now, as we come into this book of Nehemiah, in the original, both Ezra and Nehemiah were one book, and you would continue to read. But as we come into this book of Nehemiah, what I want to do is to in a sense, not quite set the scenes, because this chapter, and it does in a sense set the scenes, but what it does is it introduces us to something of the heart that God was working in Nehemiah. Why did Nehemiah do extraordinary things for God? Why might we be able to do extraordinary things for God? It's because God writes into our heart that passion for the lost and the passion for his kingdom, just as we see in Nehemiah. So we're going to look deeply, more deeply into this. And I do long that as we look at this passage tonight together, that God would give in our hearts a desire for his kingdom purposes, that God would place in our hearts a desire for the lost, that God would enable us to see with the eyes that he sees and looks upon this world, that he would burden us also, and he would cause us to respond in the same way as Nehemiah. And you know, you just don't know what God will do through you. And so I long that God would also give you a heart which is usable for him. Well, the first thing I want you to see in here was that he was prepared by the Lord. He was prepared by the Lord, verses 1 and 2. Now, you know, the most remarkable thing about these verses and this whole chapter, actually, is that Nehemiah actually bothered at all. Now, you might go, well, what are you talking about? Well, if you were in a position like Nehemiah, such a privileged position, and you heard news of what was going on in Jerusalem, then your most likely response would probably be, well, that's nothing to do with me. That's hundreds and hundreds of miles away. God's already sent people there. They can get down to it. That's their responsibility. Maybe they're not as committed as they ought to be. Maybe they've actually not right in their own hearts before God. And I'm okay. God's put me here. God's given me an incredible position. God's given me a work to do here. And so he could very easily have just responded by this, that God has already placed him where God wants him, and that's the end of it. So the most remarkable thing, I think, about this book is that Nehemiah responds at all. Why did he respond? Well, because God was working in his heart. God had put something in his heart. And there were remarkable things afoot. And what I want you to see, I love it when I'm working with people pastorally, and you know, the situation is a total mess. And sometimes you're praying with people over months or years, and when God puts it all back together again, when God works it out, it's almost like there's a jigsaw puzzle which has been thrown down, and there's all these pieces all over the place, and suddenly it all comes together. God works in lots of little bits all over the place, and it all comes together perfectly. And there were remarkable things afoot here, and I want you to see that. First of all, there was the position. There was the position. He was a cup bearer to the king. We read that at the very end of our passage at verse 11. Now, I'm sure you're aware of what a cup bearer did. Maybe you're not. Maybe you think you just carry cups. What did a cup bearer do? Well, the biggest danger for a king in those days was poisoning, and so they had a person who was the cup bearer. And what the cup bearer would do is the cup bearer would put a ladle into the vessel which was held the wine, and would take that ladle out. He would pour a little bit into his other hand, and so he'd cup his hand. He'd pour a little bit into his hand. He would drink that bit of wine first of all. If nothing happened to him, well, he would pour that into the glass, and we'd give the same glass to the king. It was a trusted position. It was a position that you would only put the person who you really wanted to genuinely trust your life in with. And so it was given. But who was this man? Well, this man was an exile, wasn't he? He was one of the conquered peoples. And you wouldn't, if you were going to put your life into someone's hand, you'd hardly put your life into the hand of an enemy, would you? And yet that's exactly what Nehemiah was. Nehemiah was an enemy. He was a foreign. He was exile. He was an immigrant, we might say. You put your life in the hand of an immigrant. He shouldn't have had that job, but God had put him there for such a time as this. So the position is interesting. Secondly, the circumstances are interesting. This is we read in verse 1, the 20th year of Artaxerxes. Now, of course, you're all well-versed in Persian history, aren't you? Well, maybe not. Maybe we don't get what this is about. You see, Artaxerxes was the son of Xerxes. Xerxes was interesting because he was the king whose wife was Esther. So we've got that little bit of history behind us. And Esther, during his reign, at the end of his reign, Xerxes was killed in his bedroom. Now, Xerxes was killed by a courier who came in and basically struck him down in his bedroom. This is how Artaxerxes came to power. Immediately after Artaxerxes took the throne, what happened was his brother attempted a revolt. And it was in the northeast of the territories this occurs quite often in history. It was in Afghanistan. And so they were going to come down from Afghanistan and they were going to try and take his kingdom. And it was his brother who attempted this revolt. Well, he put down that revolt, but 5 years later, there was another attempted revolt, this time from the south of his kingdom, from Egypt, and the Athenians had joined with the Egyptians, and they decided to try and overthrow Xerxes. Artaxerxes put down that revolt as well. Well, there were 10 years of peace, and then about 3 years before this time, there was another revolt. This time, the revolt was in the kingdom known as Trans-Euphrates. Where was Trans-Euphrates? Well, that was the kingdom which was over the parts which we would know as modern-day Israel. The person who was in charge, the satrap in charge of Trans-Euphrates, he decided to rebel against the kingdom, and so that was also put down. Now, it was probably about that time, that revolt, that if you were to go back in your Bibles to Ezra in chapter 4, you discover that Ezra puts in there some letters which were sent between kings, and he suddenly jumps way forward in time from where they are there, about 70 years forward in time, to the time when this revolt of Artaxerxes took place in the Trans-Euphrates. And what happened, of course, is that they had this revolt, and then the Jews, having completed the temple, decided to start to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem for themselves. And of course, because there's just been a rebellion in that area, well, Artaxerxes would hardly want to have another powerful city being built in that area who are going to revolt against them again. So, of course, the letter comes from the people there complaining that these Jews are trying to build their wall. What does Artaxerxes do? Well, immediately he writes back going, stop the work. And so the work was stopped there. And humanly speaking, no one could have done anything about this. The word of a king of the Medes and Persians can't be changed. And so if you go back to Esther and you have a look in Esther, when the law was written about the Jews being destroyed, he had to provide another way around that law because the word of the Medes and Persians kings can't be changed. And so how can God change this so that the wall can be built again? Ah, but God had put Nehemiah there, who was the most trusted person that was with Artaxerxes, who was the person who had more contact with Artaxerxes, 3 meals in the day, one person there every single meal. Who was that person? It was Nehemiah. You see, and God had put Nehemiah there, but not only that, God had already put Mordecai, had already put Esther, had already put Ezra there beforehand. In other words, God had prepared this king's heart with his people there, ready for the work that God was going to do. The circumstances were quite incredible. And then there was a situation. In verse 2, his brother comes back, and maybe it's not long after the work on the wall stops. His brother comes back to him. And why just then? Well, we don't know. Why with this particular news? Well, we don't know, but his brother came along, and Nehemiah questioned him about what was happening, and Nehemiah got to find out what was going on, and God put this upon Nehemiah's heart, so he was totally broken man over what was going on. And what was going on? Well, God was at work. God was at work. God was at work in the king. God was at work in Nehemiah and his position. And God was at work in that situation. And I love this. All these little details, and God is absolutely sovereign over the whole situation. He had his person in his place, for his purposes, prepared to do his will. And all that was sorted right the way through this time when the rebellion was going on. Now, isn't this exciting? You might go, no, it's just historic detail. It is exciting because, you see, you do not know the purposes for which God has put you in the place he's put you. You do not see. If you were to ask Nehemiah, how did he get that position? Well, maybe he worked his way up through. We don't know. But what was this position for? Well, Nehemiah couldn't have told you that. What was he going to be doing in a few years' time? Nehemiah couldn't have told you that. He had no understanding of what God was doing. But God had already got all these purposes lined up. He knew exactly what he was doing. He was preparing Nehemiah for this very time. And you know why it's exciting? Because God does that for each one of us. You're put in your office place. You're put in your neighborhood beside the people who you live beside, your neighbors. You're given your friends. All these things are part of God preparing you. And what I love is that even those pictures I showed you before, that the man who was the Queen's Counsel, he was the one who got me up to speak in public, first of all. They could understand me there because it was Belfast and it was fine. And he got me up to preach. And that was the first time I'd ever done that. And what did I know that God was going to use that in the time to come? What did I know that God was going to use that opportunity to contact the people in the crowd to train me up on how to do evangelism? I knew nothing about it. I was a teenager of kind of 16, 17 years old. I knew nothing about it. But here's the thing. God did. God did. One of the most confusing things that happened to me was when God called me into ministry. I was praying that, you know, God had challenged me and God had called me in towards ministry, and I talked to some Christian leaders about it, and they felt it was right, and, you know, test the call and so on. And then almost immediately, God opened up an opportunity for employment in the University of Bath. And I'm going, but God, you've just called me into pastoral ministry. What's going on here? What's the point of all this? Little was I to know that I was going to walk into a situation where the department was at hugely low ebb, where the previous person who had my job and the person before that had both quit their job because of the pressures of the job that they had and the pressures upon them. A department which divided among itself and needed to be totally turned around, a department which needed a new vision, a new direction, and needed to be led forward, needed the difficulties within the department sorted out, needed to sit down with people and to resolve all the difficulties that couldn't be unresolved. And by the way, you know, if those are skills that you ever need in a church, if any of those skills you ever need in a church, they've got to be the core skills. And that's what God was doing. God gave me 3 years of absolute misery in that job and 2 years of wonderful time in that job. But those 3 years of misery he used to prepare me for the work that God had for me to do. And I think this is exciting, isn't it? Because God has his hand on you. And you might go, yes, but I'm towards the end of my life. Can I just say, Caleb was 85 years old when he said, give me this mountain. And as I've used before, the illustration of the man in my previous church, 103, was dying and was in an old people's home. Couldn't see, couldn't really hear, but he just shone for the Lord. And because of him, there were people who came along to the church, and because of him, there were people who heard the gospel, even in his dying days. You do not know what God has got planned for you. Have we got hearts which are prepared to be used by the Lord, whatever time of life that we are in? Well, he was prepared by the Lord. Secondly, he wept with the Lord. He wept with the Lord, verse 2-4. God had not only prepared the circumstance, he prepared his heart. And what I love is that see, Nehemiah could have ignored it, couldn't he, completely, as we said. He had important things to do. After all, he'd got a really important position, hadn't he? He could have just gone, well, that's really sad, isn't it, and moved on. He could have done what probably most of us in that position would do, a well-paid job, you know, write a check to the Save the Jerusalem Walls Fund and send it off. You know, that's it all sorted, that's it all done. You know, why didn't he do that? Why didn't he respond in this way? You know, we can so often do that, can't we? It's we walk down the street, and there was a man, just as I was walking along here tonight, and three men staggered out of the side, a side passage. And two of them staggered onto the road, and with traffic coming down the road, so blind drunk that they turned round, had a conversation with the other guy who was on the pavement, stood in the middle of the road, and they staggered off into the park, and this other guy staggered into the pub again. And we can see these things, and we can kind of shrug our shoulders. It's a bit like when I was in India, and you could choose between first class, second class, air-conditioned, second class, or third class. Third class is cattle class. You don't want to be there as a visitor. Second class air-conditioned, that's quite nice. First class is really nice. You probably can't afford it, so you go second class air-conditioned. When I was in India, we decided not to go second class air-conditioned, but to go second class. And the reason why is I was with a missionary, and the missionary there said, look, I could put you in second class air-conditioned, but then India would pass you by. You'd look out your window, and you'd see India in the distance, but you wouldn't actually meet India. I'm going to put you in second class so that you can see India and so that God can use it to impact your hearts. And we can be like that, can't we? We can be going through this world in second class air conditions, and we're watching at the world through the window, but we don't actually let it impact our heart. But it impacted Nehemiah's heart, and God was at work. And how do I know that? Because of what he did. First of all, he said in verse 2, I questioned them. This wasn't a chance meeting with his brother. What he did, the Hebrew there means to consult or to demand. He's demanding answers. He's wanting to know. Nehemiah's going out of his way to find out why, because he had concern for God's people. Verse 2, about the Jewish remnant. That word remnant in verse 2 is a biblical word. It's used in Isaiah chapter 10, verse 20 to 22. And it's about God's promise of a remnant who will return. It's about God's promise of blessing to his people. So what did Nehemiah have in his heart? Nehemiah had on his heart God's word and God's promises. He knew what God had promised to do. It wasn't random questioning. He was wanting to see if God was at work and God fulfilling the work that he said he was going to do. And then in verse 4 we read, when I heard these things, I sat down and wept. Why did he weep? What was it that moved him so much? There were just news of walls. What was it that moved him so much? He wept because his heart was in tune with the heart of God. He knew that his God was an awesome God. He knew God was powerful. He knew that God was taking his people back. He knew what God's promises were. And he knew that it had taken 20 years to complete the temple. And now 92 years since the exiles had gone back to start the work on the temple. And God's city was still in ruins. That we need to get into the hearts of people that time. I just want to read some words from Psalm 79. Psalm 79, the Psalm of Asaph said this, oh God, the nations have invaded your inheritance. They have defiled your holy temple. They have reduced Jerusalem to rubble. They have given the dead bodies of your servants as food for the birds of the air, the flesh of your saints as to the beasts of the field. They have poured out blood like water all around Jerusalem, and there is no one to bury the dead. We are objects of reproach to our neighbors, of scorn and derision to those around us. How long, O Lord? How long? How long will your jealousy burn out, burn like a fire? Oh, you see the passion that's there. The desire for God to work. And that was the same passion that was on Nehemiah's heart. How long will we be a reproach to the nations? How long will we be scorned to those around us? And it wasn't a passing mention. It was a permanent passion. You see, for verse 4 you read, for some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. Here was a man who God had prepared, whose heart was God's heart. Here is a man who had a heart in line with God's heart. What do we read of Jesus when he came to Jerusalem? That he looked on Jerusalem with his spiritual sight, and he saw the sad state of a people who constantly had rejected God's call to them. And he said, as he approached Jerusalem, Luke chapter 19, verse 41, he saw the city, and Jesus wept over it. Brothers and sisters, how we need to have a heart like that. God established this church coming up to 175 years ago. What has God's work been through this church? There's been so much that's happened, isn't there? But when we look out there, do we see God's kingdom come in this place? Do we see a people whose hearts are turning to the Lord? You know, if we were people who really were after God's kingdom and God's promises there, then we would look with different eyes. Uzziah became king, and when he became king, he saw the desolation of the temple in the first month of his reign, and he got down and he wept before the Lord and worked. Josiah, when he became king as a child and as he grew up into adulthood, he saw the pollution of the idols, and he went and cleansed the land. He had a passion that moved his heart. And Paul, when he entered Athens, he saw the godlessness of it all to an unknown God, and he can't help himself, and he started to proclaim the gospel. You see, how do we respond to what we see around us? It's so easy, isn't it, to be second class air conditioned or first class and let the world pass us by. But do we have the heart of God? How do we respond? Well, Jeremiah chapter 9, verse 1, prayed, "Oh, that my head was a spring of water and my eyes were a fountain of tears. I would weep day and night for the slain of my people." What did Jeremiah do? He realized that he should be in tears for the situation and said, "God, you work in my heart. You give me the spiritual eyes that see. You change my hard heart into a heart which is soft and passionate for your kingdom." And maybe that's what we need. Maybe that's what we need in this place. Oh, my time is out. I haven't even got to verse 5 yet. I don't mean to show you what the end thing is. I'm not going to go through this, but what was his response? Well, he prayed to the Lord. This is so important. Have you ever driven in a dual-control car? Learning to drive, probably you drove a dual control car. If everything goes horribly wrong, what should you do? This is a pop question. Anybody know the answer? Anything goes horribly wrong, what should you do? Yeah, let go of the controls. That's right, let the instructor take over. Exactly. Let go of the controls. Let the instructor take over. And that's exactly, you know, when we look upon this world and we see everything going wrong, we see God's people have so little impact in this place, and that's the thing that struck me most when I come to Cheltenham. 22 evangelical churches in this place, and we see so little impact. What should be our heart's response? Well, we could get out there and get doing things, and we've got to do that, but there's a first step before that. We've got to stop, and we've got to let go of the controls. We've got to go, "Lord, you've got to take over. You've got to touch our hearts. You've got to work in this place. You've got to demonstrate. Lord, we want you to show us how we can reach this people." Alan Redpath said this: "There's too much working before men, and there's too little waiting before God." Too much working before men and too little waiting for God, before God. And Nehemiah had learned this, and the whole book is a book of prayer. There are 10 prayers, 406 verses, and there are 10 prayers that take up these verses. 11% of this book of Nehemiah is prayers. 11%. He spends his time in prayer, and that's why God uses him so much. He recognizes God's power. He recognizes God's power. God is the great God of heaven, the great and awesome God. It's so easy when we see the lack of impact to just think that, well, there is no power there, there's no authority, there's nothing that can happen. But we have a great God, don't we? Our God is an awesome God. Our God is the one who has promised so much here. We have a God in heaven who, when all the world can offer is idols, we have a God who is great and awesome, far above all powers and authorities. We have a God who keeps his covenant of love, and he will bring to pass his word, and we need to remind ourselves of who he is. He recognized God's purity, verses 6 to 7, and he comes to the root of the problem. What's the root of the problem? Well, actually, the root of the problem is we have acted wickedly against you. Now, brothers and sisters, when we look upon the world and we see that God has not impacted the world through us, there's got to be something in our hearts. And we are sinful people, we know that. Oh, but we need to be those who bow our knees before the Lord and say, "Lord, deal with me. Give me a heart of compassion. Forgive me for my lack of compassion for those who are lost around me." Isaiah said this: "Woe is me, I'm a man of unclean lips. I live among a people of unclean lips. But my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of glory." If we're going to be of much use for the Lord, we've got to see more of the Lord. And when we see more of the Lord, he impacts the sin of our hearts and we recognize his purity. And thirdly, he recognized God's promises. You know, verse 8 to 10 are amazing verses. We haven't got time to go through them, but what does he do? He's actually praying from five different Bible passages. And those two verses, he's quoting from five different Bible. In other words, he knows God's promises. He knows God's promises. And so he gets down and he's praying God's promises. Oh, Lord, you've said that you're going to bring the desired of all nations. So, Lord, do that in Cheltenham. Lord, you've said that you'll build your church. So, Lord, do that in Cheltenham. Lord, you've said that your people are a light set on a hill. So do that in Cheltenham. Lord, come and do what you have promised to do. This is the confidence we read in 1 John chapter 5, that we have in approaching God, that if we ask anything in accordance to his will, he hears us. And if we know that he hears us, whatever we ask, we know that we shall have what we have asked of him. Brothers and sisters, you know what we desperately need tonight. We need to realize our hearts are hard, that we have a mighty God who is able to save, and say, oh Lord, touch my heart, humble my heart, change my heart, give me a heart that weeps over the lost. Lord, come and have your way amongst us. And just like Nehemiah here, that we recognize our own sinfulness and God's purity, but more than that, we recognize God's promises. Lord, you've placed us here for such a time as this. Use us in this place. Do incredible things through us. You know, if we're going to be a church that really moves forward, we maybe have to stop doing some of the things we do to make time for prayer. Real, heartfelt, intercessory prayer. Lord, have your way amongst us. I hope when we get further into the year to call people to prayer. And I don't mind if I only have a few people who come. I hope that won't be the case. But I do want people who God is impacting their hearts. How long, O Lord? How long? Lord, won't you do more in this place? Lord, you've equipped us, you've placed people amongst us. Won't you move in this place? Oh Lord, come and work. Come and work and build your kingdom in this place.